He has been an assistant Wayne County prosecutor, the deputy Wayne County executive under Edward McNamara. He was the CEO of the Detroit Medical Center. Today, Mike Duggan is making it official. He wants to be Detroit's next mayor. Let's take a closer look at the Duggan candidacy as we welcome from the Detroit Free Press writer Rochelle Riley. Hi, Rochelle.
Hello. How are you?
Good. You had a big piece in today's Free Press. You sat down with Mike Duggan and talked with him, and he told you he wants to be mayor. So here's the question. It's been since 1973 since there was a white candidate in a Detroit mayoral race. Are Detroiters ready to vote for a white candidate?
Well, see, I don't know that that's the question. I think the question is, are people going to finally realize that not everybody in Detroit is the same? There have been people in Detroit who have looked at leadership first and the content of character over color for a long time. But because the belief is that most people wouldn't, you have not had a sort of diversity of candidacy that might be helpful for the conversation. If Mike Duggan does nothing else, and he may be capable of more, he is going to change the conversation over this next 9 months. And that could be one of the best things to happen for Detroit since Punch Keith.
Very true. And punch keys are good things that happen from Detroit. That is a long overdue thing to open up, isn't it?
Yes. It's a part of what has been missing. It's a different kind of conversation about race. And there's nothing wrong with talking about race.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk about it all the time. You know, every now and again, someone will call and go, oh, why do you want to talk about race? Please don't bring that up. Things are better. Things are never better if only one group of people is talking about race.
There you go. Now, we know that whoever runs against Mike Duggan is going to bring up the fact that he recently moved to the city from Livonia and that he is white. So how is he prepared to answer that?
Well, I will tell you what I wrote in a column, and this isn't for Mike Duggan. This is for anybody who wants to do anything for Detroit. I don't want somebody to tell me where somebody sleeps. I want them to tell me where they live and work. And all of the work that he's done, I guess maybe 20 or 25 years, has been for Detroit, whether it was, you know, Wayne County and Detroit benefited from it, or the work with the DMC. I say this about any people who are doing great things in the city and happen to live in the suburbs. These are suburbs of the city. And no place else have I ever lived or ever heard of where there's such a wall and people make such a big difference if you don't live downtown.
Rochelle, stack Mike Duggan up against the other candidates and possible candidates. Let's go with the existings first. With Lisa Howes, you have Fred Durrell and Crystal Crittenden. How does he stack up against them?
Well, if you believe polls, and I rarely do, you know, he and Benny Napoleon are far and away ahead of all of these other candidates. I will tell you that I've talked to real people, and that means people whose names you don't see in the paper all the time and who do a lot of work, who think that Crystal Crittenden's grassroots campaign is going to take off in a way that people don't expect. I think that Lisa Howes is somebody who is a very capable person and probably can do great things. I think she just may have run too soon. I talk sometimes about this musical chairs, and no one said it better than Charles Pugh in the piece I wrote about his deciding not to be mayor. He said there should be a limit on people doing these different public servant jobs and just going from one job to the other. I'm not suggesting that about Lisa, but somebody who's a state rep then becomes a county commissioner and then becomes a city council member. And so they're just sort of, you know, taking these public jobs. I want somebody who wants that job and just that job. And Mike Duggan is not the only one to say it. Benny Napoleon, who has done other jobs and is now the county sheriff, wants that job. I think I'm hoping he's going to tell people he wants it. If he doesn't, it'd be nice if he'd go ahead and say so and make our lives easier in the media.
Instead of trying to figure how much to dance around that possibility of a candidacy.
I think that what people want is to have a conversation about needs, about rights, about crime. And if you spend too much time on race and on negativity, you're not going to have the conversation you need to have. So I think that every candidate should be wary of that, because that's what I'm hearing more than anything.
What do you think, Rochelle Riley, are the main positives about a Mike Duggan candidacy?
You know, I'm not his campaign manager, so I don't have a spiel on his behalf, but I can tell you he made his own case in my piece that ran today when he talked to me a day before his official announcement to, you know, let people know that what he's been doing all of this time is true. I think that he brings some expertise in turnaround. Anybody who could stave off a major corporation and a hospital system from bankruptcy and, you know, who kept Wayne County, helped to keep Wayne County from going broke. You can't dismiss something like that on a resume when Detroit looks like it does. Now, does that mean that nobody else can do it? Of course not. But he's touting that because that's the big thing.
How do you see the appointment of a state manager impacting the mayoral race? If that shoe drops in Lansing with a great big thud and Governor Snyder appoints a manager, how do you see that impacting the race, or do you?
Oh, it would definitely. Well, I don't know if it would impact the race. I don't know that there's somebody who was considering running who would not run because they won't be in total charge. If that's the case, then that lets you know they weren't somebody that you needed to vote for anyway. But it's going to make a huge difference in how that work gets done. And what you want is a mayor who understands that if that happens, and it only happens if, you know, Governor Snyder can find somebody to do the job, and he apparently, from what I'm hearing, is having a hard time. You want to make sure that they work in partnership so that however long that person is there, good work is getting done and they don't have to stay there for years.
Well, it'll be interesting as we watch this. And as you say, nobody's got a sense yet when Benny Napoleon may jump into the race. And certainly Mayor Bing hasn't put any cards on the table either.
He has not made any type of announcement. We've been hearing, you know, here and there about fundraisers, but people raise funds and they do that to see how many funds they can raise. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. But once again, if he is planning to do it, I think it's the kind of thing you want people to know sooner rather than later.
Rochelle Riley of the Detroit Free Press, thanks so much for talking with us today, Rochelle.
Thank you.
Just think, someone takes a mass of bronze and turns it into something that captures the likeness and even more the spirit of a person who's truly an icon to millions. In other words, get it right because people all over the world will be watching. That was the assignment given to the Daubin Furman Sculpture Studio of California in 2005. Create a bronze statue of Rosa Parks. The mother of the modern civil rights movement would have been 100 this month. So it's very, very fitting. The piece will be revealed and dedicated tomorrow at the U.S. Capitol. It was the first commission of a full-size statue approved and funded by Congress since, are you ready, 1873. And it's the first full-size representation of an African-American woman in the National Statuary Hall. Rob Furman and Eugene Daub were the sculptors chosen to create the Rosa Parks statue. And Eugene Daub joins us now from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
As you were working on the statue, Eugene Daub, I'm curious, it's untold hours of time. What are you thinking about as you are designing and sculpting her face?
Well, not only the face, but, you know, the whole piece, it's a matter of trying to hide the unnecessary and reveal the important parts, and to reveal the things that help to reveal dignity or vision. And those things are, I mean, these are just words, and it's another thing to try to get the piece to actually feel like that, and have that look or have that feeling.
And I know as small in stature as she was, she certainly had a powerful spirit. And I've loved how in interviews in later years, she said she was quite annoyed at the popular legend that her feet were tired. She said, I was just tired of being tired,
right,
of not being able to sit where I wanted to. You could just tell there was quite a spirit in there.
Yes, yes. It's I sort of imagine her like a superwoman and sort of the Clark Kent syndrome, you know. It's we wanted her to really people to look at her as a superwoman, but sort of with a Clark Kent exterior, you know, dressed in mid-century clothes.
So tomorrow, as the president and congressional leaders are there, what does that feel like to actually have that creation that you've labored over shown on such a very, very public stage?
Well, it is just an honor and a privilege, and, you know, it's I just said to somebody just recently, I just feel like Daniel Day-Lewis and Lincoln, you know, having a chance to work on Rosa Parks. It's a chance that we have to come close to greatness, you know, not ours but theirs. And just as artists, when we can we've worked on a lot of pieces of just wonderful, great people, Lincoln, Jefferson, Rosa Parks. It's a wonderful vicarious experience to, you know, just rub the shoulders in any way with them. It's just great.
Eugene Daub and Rob Furman created the Rosa Parks statue to be unveiled tomorrow at the Capitol before President Obama and congressional leaders. Joining me now is Reynard Ross. He's the director of Upward Bound for Grand Rapids Community College. And right now he's serving on a panel organized to address the increase in violence in Grand Rapids. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And joining me from Chicago, Kobe Williams, who has been working as a violence interrupter with Cure Violence. Welcome to Stateside, Kobe.
Thanks a lot.
Good to have you. Reynard, I'd like to start with you. Can you give us a sense, being right there on the ground in Grand Rapids, what has been going on, especially over the past couple of months?
I don't know if I can say it any other way than borderline madness. Just a lot of retaliatory violence. This town is relatively small, so the degrees of separation with some of these folks involved is, you know, no more than 1 or 2 degrees top. So when one thing happens, it's very easy to run across or find someone else on the other side of the conflict. And some of the things we found, which makes Cure Violence, you know, attractive to us, is that a lot of this is really just occurring based off of often some misunderstandings, and things begin to snowball and escalate. And next thing you know, we have something that's occurring that could have been squashed with some intervention early on, or interrupting, if you would, early on. So just trying to get a handle on this, obviously.
Yeah, in fact, I saw a quote in one news story that one of the pastors in Grand Rapids put it so well. He said, "Our hearts are bleeding." And as you said to me, this is a smaller community, so this has just got to have an incredible impact.
Yes, it does. And that's sort of what, I mean, I have a sort of a personal history of being involved in some of this, but as far as violence reduction, I'm also a former police officer in Eastern Manistee, juvenile detention center here in town. And in my work with children through my role as director of Grand Rapids Community College Upper Bound, I just for years have been in direct contact with young people in Grand Rapids, and just too often those involved on either side of the gun are young people that I've had a good relationship with in different capacities. And so personally, just been a little driven to like my generation has a bigger responsibility as opposed to shaking our head and talking about the problems. I've just sort of committed to try to be more solution-oriented. I think we all understand the problems well enough, and it's time to try to address the problems, really. So I'm just trying to put my energies in that direction.
Kobe Williams, you are a violence interrupter with Cure Violence in Chicago. And as I understand it, the key to cure violence is to treat violence not like a moral failing or something you can arrest away, but like a disease?
Right. We look at violence as a disease that spread from one person to another. So what we do is we get out there in the community and build relationships on an everyday basis. Once we build relationships, get to know people, talk to the people in the community and all that, but we do a lot of listening more to the community and listen to the young men and the young ladies. So our whole approach is focus on reduce the shooting and killing it, but also help you change your thinking and mindset. One thing we don't do, we don't be judgmental. We don't go around telling people you shouldn't be in the gang, you shouldn't sell drugs, you shouldn't do this. We listen more to them and build that relationship. Once we're able to build that relationship to them, then we go into their little world, you know, meeting them and hearing them, meeting them where they are. So it's so important to meet people where they are. And then we'll bring them into our little world and showing what we're doing now. But it's about building that relationship, not just rushing out there, you know, being judgmental and all that. It's about to get to know them, man.
And you are a violence interrupter. What does that mean? What do you do?
A violence interrupter is somebody, I'm like a firefighter. I was in the community. When something is erupting in the community, it's my job to put out the flame. It's my job to stop the shooting and killing. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis out there. You know, mediating conflicts. When something is erupting in the community, it's my job to put out the flame. It's my job to make sure I squash things. It's my job to stop things on the front end. When I hear something going on, it's my job to get out there and stop it. Once somebody gets shot or killed or something, it's my job to get out there to try to stop retaliation.
And that has to bring danger.
I mean, most of us, we come, we me, myself, I was part of the problem, and now I'm part of the solution. We come from these areas, most of the workers. We come from these communities and these neighborhoods on an everyday. This is what we grew up in. So, I mean, it can be dangerous, but we don't look at it as being dangerous. We look at it, you know, me, myself, I took so much out the communities, and I just want to get back to the community.
Because you're from that world.
Yes.
You know, I think, you know, he raised a good point as far as the direct interventions and interrupting, I suppose. And, you know, I think one thing we're starting to understand here in Grand Rapids, and probably a lot of people are around the country, is that you have to approach this violence piece with sort of a two-pronged approach. Obviously, one is the immediate reduction of violence, sort of like the, you know, putting your finger in the dike, so to speak, to stop the flood.
Sure.
But two, you obviously have to deal with some of the causal issues, and that's where the science, I guess, comes in. Because in treating us like an illness or an infection, I mean, this is definitely a public health issue. So with any public health issue, you need to do things to change social and behavioral norms, you know, particularly for those who are most likely to spread the illness. And it's intriguing to us in this community, and we believe it has some merit, and hopefully can help us stem the tide here.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking today with Raynard Ross, who is serving on a panel organized to address the huge increase in gun violence in Grand Rapids. And Kobe Williams, he's been working as a violence interrupter with Cure Violence in Chicago, and they're looking to bring in Cure Violence with violence interrupters to try to stop the cycle of violence in Grand Rapids. And Kobe, as you've been working in Chicago, can you actually measure a decrease in deaths from violence?
I mean, see, here in Chicago, Cure Violence, we only like work 15 to 20% of Chicago. When I was out there on an everyday basis, I was working in the Englewood community on the south side of Chicago. I mean, I definitely see a change with some of these young people, because like I said, you got to establish the relationship with them. If you think about changing their mindset and their thinking, you got to be out there on an everyday basis. You got to be in the community every day. You got to get to know them more. And when things are taking place in the community, they will call you. So I see a lot of people change because I do a lot of follow-up contacts with them. And how I could tell that they making a difference and making change in their thinking and all that, because I talk to them about, have you been involved in any more conflicts? Have you talked somebody down for shooting or want to kill somebody? Have you done any of that? So that's how I'd be trying to measure a lot of the workers. I mean, a lot of the participants and clients we're working with out there. Once I see that and see what they're doing now on an everyday basis, I see it's works.
What would it take to bring this program into Grand Rapids, Mr. Ross?
Like I said, the first thing, and I guess let me actually add to something, you know, the question you asked, Kobe. I've been doing a bit of a research, and I do know based off a Department of Justice study that the area that Kobe used to work had a 40% reduction in shootings, and actually the Department of Justice done through Northwestern University found that there was a 100% reduction in retaliation homicide. So apparently, you know, that's what's intrigued me is the data, and I guess to answer a question on what we need to do to bring that to Grand Rapids is obviously there's an economic component associated with this. I met with the National Director of Cure Violence, and just ballpark, we estimate roughly $250,000 a year for a three-year pilot. And so before we obviously get to that point of looking to identify funds or funders, it's important for us to first spend a day and a half in Chicago to really get the ins and outs of the model, and us deciding as a committee if we believe that Cure Violence is a part of the solution for us in Grand Rapids. It definitely can't hurt, and will very likely help if the city gets behind it. That will help us in our quest to acquire some of those funds through public and private avenues.
Raynard Ross of Grand Rapids, community leader, and Kobe Williams, violence interrupter for Cure Violence in Chicago. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, please.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
From Grand Rapids now to Detroit, where a group from Washington, D.C. is hoping to get elementary, middle, and high school kids excited about playwriting. The group is called the Young Playwrights Theater, and the leaders of this program are launching a four-city tour starting in Detroit, reaching out to key education figures, and spreading the Young Playwrights Theater curriculum to classrooms outside of Washington. Joining me now is the executive director of the Young Playwrights Theater, YPT for short, Bridget Pribnow-Moore. And we have the artistic director, Nicole Jost, as well. I'd like to start with you, Bridget. Why did you specifically look at Detroit for expanding Young Playwrights Theater?
Sure. So we were looking for cities that had school systems where the student population had similar demographics to the students that we work with in D.C. and where the schools and the students themselves were facing similar challenges. So in D.C., you know, we have students who struggle with low test scores. We have struggles with attendance and participation in class. And it does seem like the schools in Detroit are facing similar challenges. And we developed this model as a way to engage students more deeply in their learning, to teach literacy skills in a way that is fun, and to provide students with the critical thinking and creativity and confidence that they need to succeed in school and beyond. So Detroit seemed like a great first city to visit to explore the possibility of using this model with a different student population.
So Nicole, as artistic director of the of YPT, what work do you do with these students? And I know it's elementary on up through high school. What is it that you do with them?
Yeah, well, our largest program is our in-school program, and that's really kind of what we're focusing on with our book and with this tour. So the in-school program, it starts with a very simple question of just what is a play? And to explore that question with students, we hire professional actors. They come in and they perform a play that doesn't have an ending. And so the teaching artist then turns out to the students and says, well, how do you think this play should end? So students kind of think about it. They articulate an idea, and then the actors play out the different endings. Well, that's the essence of playwriting. So that's just the first taste, and that's just a way for the teaching artist to say, look, you've already done this. You're creative. You're intelligent mm-hmm. students. You have the power to do this. And from there, they move through workshops on developing characters, on creating strong conflict and drama, and they do some writing in the classroom, so they have one-on-one attention with the teaching artist. And then finally, it culminates at every age level with readings of the students' plays that they've completed. And we bring professional actors back into the classroom, and they actually perform a selection from every single student's play. So all of our students get to see, you know, from page to stage.
And every time I've heard an interview or read an interview with a writer, whether it's a screenplay, whether it's writing for the theater, that they describe that amazing rush of hearing actors speaking your words. I'll tell you who I remember. Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, said when he heard all of these people, Elizabeth Moss and John Hamm, speaking his words. So I would imagine that that thrill is just as great for a fifth grader.
Well, if not more. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Imagine having that experience, but being a student who up to that point did not believe that you had something valuable to say, that anybody was interested in listening to you, how empowering that would be. I mean, these are not professional artists who are doing this for their career. This is a first-time, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for these students and a life-changing one.
We're speaking with folks from the Young Playwrights Theater in Washington, D.C. We have the executive director, Bridget Pribnow-Moore, and the artistic director, Nicole Jost. And they're launching a four-city tour beginning in Detroit, wanting to bring this experience of the Young Playwrights Theater to particularly at-risk students, elementary, middle school, and high school. You've taken out of the thousands of plays that have been produced or have been written by students through the Young Playwrights Theater, you've put it into a book called Right to Dream. You've taken some of the cream of the crop and also a curricula. But before we talk about the curricula that's in the book, give us an idea of what some of the plays are about. Bridget, what are these children writing about?
Oh, my
about?
Gosh. It's amazing. So we work with elementary, middle, and high school mm-hmm. students. And so the topics that they write about really run the gamut. In elementary school, we have these really imaginative plays about superheroes, plays about talking animals, kind of different takes on fairy tales. And then in middle school, we have a lot of plays about students discovering themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, really learning who they are, answering that question: who am I? How do I relate to my peers? What am I doing in school?
Yes.
And then in high school, they get grittier, and they start looking at the world around them. We get a lot of social justice topics. It's just a different level. So the plays in the book, there are 30 plays, and they span the past 17 years. So they're some of the best plays created by elementary, middle, and high school students. And in the book, they are divided by age appropriateness. So mm-hmm. we have a section that is for all ages, a section that is appropriate for 13 and up, and then some of the grittier plays in 16 and up. So there is really something for anybody in this book.
And Nicole Jost, as the artistic director, talk to me about the depth of what these young writers are putting onto their onto paper.
Sure. Well, I'll talk about one of my favorite plays from art history, and one of my favorite plays in the book is a play called Society Unjust by Shannon Marshall. And Shannon was really interested in gentrification, which is a huge issue in D.C. It's a huge issue in our kind of home base neighborhood in Columbia Heights. The neighborhood has just experienced rapid change over the past few years. So Shannon wrote a play where there's an old woman, and she's kind of dealing with the struggle of, not knowing whether she wants to sell her house to this developer who she knows is going to turn it into like a coffee shop or something and, mm-hmm. and change her neighborhood. And so she's struggling with that. You know, she doesn't know if she needs the money to maybe pay medical bills, and it's just, you know, she's caught in this struggle. And then I guess I won't give away the ending of the play, but Shannon actually is also a wonderful poet. So she closes the play with this beautiful poem, and it's just incredible. I mean, it's one of the plays where when we produced it, as we do with professional artists in a professional theater, my father actually said to me, "I don't believe you. That play was not written by a high school student. You're trying to pull the wool over my eyes." I said, "No, Dad, that's Shannon Marshall. I'll introduce you." So, they take on themes like gentrification, gang violence, teen pregnancy. It's amazing.
Also, for teachers who might be listening to us, or parents who would like their children to have the opportunity to learn to write and express themselves, you also have curricula.
Yes, the entire second half of the book are sample workshops that we actually use in the classroom to mm-hmm. teach playwriting. Every workshop is tied to Common Core standards for English language arts at the elementary, middle, and high school level. So our dream is that this book will be used by classroom teachers around the country, that teachers will take our curriculum, will adapt it to teach to the Common Core standards that they're already required to teach to, in an engaging way. So the book is available nationally. It is on Amazon. I encourage anyone who is excited about using this model in the classroom or even in their home to check it out.
Wonderful work. Young Playwrights Theater. And we've been speaking with Bridget Pribno-Moore, who is the executive director and artistic director, Nicole Jost. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the clouds seem to lift for the U.S. car companies, with car sales and America's economy picking up, there are some who are looking further down the road, and they're wondering if deeper, bigger challenges lie ahead for the companies who put the world on wheels. One of those wondering is longtime business journalist Mickey Maynard. She recently published a couple of pieces in Forbes magazine exploring what she calls the secret fear of the world's biggest auto companies. Mickey joins us in the studio. Hi, Mickey.
Hi, Cindy.
So what is the secret fear of the world's biggest auto companies?
Well, to use some automotive jargon, what everybody around the world, not just in Detroit, is worried about is called peak car. So that would mean that auto sales have basically hit the top level of where they're going to be around the world. So if you're thinking that 10 years, 20 years out, we're just going to see more and more growth of automobile sales, actually, there are some academics who are saying, no, we're hitting peak car right about now.
So we're saying for all those enticing new markets that auto companies are looking at, China being one of them, there's a point where they bought all the cars they're going to buy?
Well, it's not so much that consumer demand has petered out, so to speak, but that governments are starting to take a really solid look at what the automobile means to society. So if you look at China, I'm sure listeners have seen those pictures of the terrible smog. Mm-hmm. One of my friends at the U.S. Embassy tweeted a picture this morning. I thought it was fog. It was smog. Mm-hmm. So even though the Chinese government has been very bullish about the auto industry, there are some signs that environmentalists are saying we have an issue, and part of that issue is automobiles. And then this is magnified in other markets around the world where you've seen unbridled growth.
So it's maybe not so much that the customers don't want them, but they may not be allowed to buy as many as they want.
That's part of the issue, but there is an issue in demand. And let me just explain that. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone who lives in Upper Michigan who needs a pickup truck is going to swap it for a bicycle. I don't think people in South Dakota are going to give up their big pickup trucks or SUVs and walk to work, because how do you walk to work on a farm? Mm-hmm. But if you look at the cities around the country, young people who move to Chicago or who are buying lofts in Detroit are actually bicycling to work, walking to work. In many, many cities, there's incredible demand for public transit. Think about Detroit actually arguing to get light rail money. Mm-hmm. So you have this combination of environmental and social worries, plus more of a shift over to public transportation, plus young people who have big college loans, big debt when they get out of school. For them, brand new cars are not the first priority. Paying those loans off is the first priority.
So they might use, let's say, a Zipcar if they needed actually a set of wheels for an afternoon, like my son and daughter-in-law have done in Chicago.
Exactly. So what I'm kind of thinking of this as is not a resistance to driving so much as a resistance to owning. So if you go to another city, you might look around and say, you know what? I only live half a mile from work. Do I really need to have a car now? Can I live in Chicago without a car? We know people mm-hmm. in Boston do. Mm-hmm. We know people in San Francisco and New York do. But now it's kind of creeping into other cities. The other thing that's happening is the bicycle movement. I think Ann Arbor is about to get rental bikes.
I think, though, wouldn't you say that's way down the road? When I think of most of just here we are in Southeast Michigan, and I think Ann Arbor is different than most of the other communities. If you live in Utica mm-hmm. and you work in Southfield, you are not bicycling.
Absolutely.
And there's no real transportation that's public transportation. You have to have a car.
There may be, though, enough of an offset of these other markets so that you can live in Utica and drive to Southfield or live in Birmingham mm-hmm. and drive to Ann Arbor. But if you live in Ann Arbor and don't leave Ann Arbor, if you live in Chicago, I think Toyota told me that they've identified 60 markets around the country where this reverse suburban to urban trend is going on. So, of course, we're going to sell cars. The question is, does the line just keep going up and up and up, or do we plateau? And that is the challenge for the car companies.
Talking with business journalist Mickey Maynard about her pieces in Forbes magazine, kind of exploring the long-term challenges facing the auto companies. And Mickey, something else you talked about in Forbes was something called the share economy is presenting another challenge. Describe that.
Exactly. Forbes had a very important story recently on this whole idea that we're not going to own things, we're going to share things. And certainly cars, as you just mentioned, zip cars, car sharing programs, anything that you don't have to own, you can see it in what's called Airbnb, the whole idea that you quietly put up a room for rent in your mm-hmm. home. And so no one stays in a hotel anymore. They rent from you. There's this whole couch surfing movement where, which is a little scary to me.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I'm sure that's a small number. I wouldn't be looking for somebody, some stranger's bedroom when I'm traveling. I'm going to a hotel.
Right.
But I just think it's probably small. But do you really think it's a serious contender?
It's one of those things where if you think 10 years back or 12 years back, the Toyota Prius was just getting here and people were wondering, would anyone ever want to buy a hybrid electric vehicle? Well, here we are 12 years later and they've sold over a million of them in the United States. So it very much could be an incremental thing where you and I might not want to couch surf, but my nephew and your kids might want to couch surf. And then as people get older and they're used to this sort of sharing economy, it seems natural to them the way going to TJ Maxx might be natural to us rather than, you know, going and splashing out on Fifth Avenue in New York.
So we're really looking down the road. Have you had conversations with auto execs about this?
I have. And I think there are two schools of thought about this. One is a school of thought that I'm crazy, that, you know, just as you said, if you live in Utica and drive to Southfield, you need a car.
Good luck.
The other is this sort of thoughtful, what do we become in the whole world where cars become like tobacco? I don't think it's that bad yet, but I do think that for some segments of society, now admittedly small, owning a car is like smoking. They don't want anything to do with it. So then if you're a car company, what is your role in the future? And that's where the whole issue of mobility providers comes
in. So what do you see their role in the future?
So if you look at all the car shows, if you look at Geneva is coming up soon, you'll see these crazy concept cars that Toyota just unveiled, a city car. They gave us a picture of it. Very ultra low emissions, small, like the smart car. But they don't want to be left out of the discussion with cities and states and governments about transportation. You look at the driverless cars. The car companies would like to build those driverless cars. They don't want Google building those driverless cars. So they want in on the conversation. Whoever the smart companies are that get in on that conversation now, they'll be at the table when it begins in earnest.
Also, the technology for moving away from carbon, emitting fuels has to keep growing.
Right.
I we know it's not where it needs to be now. But can that, as that technology improves, will that alter the situation?
That's going to be part of it. You know, gas prices are going way up really fast. And nobody knows really what's behind this current increase in gas prices. But people have limited budgets. People look at what they can skimp on, what they can cut out. You know, maybe we don't see people give up cars altogether, but they go from 2 to 1. And maybe for the second one, they do get a Zipcar. Avis just bought Zipcar, and Avis is a big rental company. So clearly they see something coming down the road.
Mickey Maynard, always good talking with you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Automotive writer and business writer Mickey Maynard. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to the issue of access to health care in our state. Who has access? Who's been left out in the cold? That question is at the heart of a newly created position at the University of Michigan Health System, the position of Associate Vice President for Health Equity and Inclusion. It's a very interesting and very clear sign that a major medical system is thinking deeply about the question of how do we get health care to as many people as possible. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Carmen Green, that newly appointed Associate Vice President for Health Equity and Inclusion. Welcome to Stateside, Dr. Green.
Thank you.
Well, what led to the creation of your job?
I would say that the University of Michigan has been really very thoughtful, the University of Michigan as well as the health system, in regards to what they see. They see a changing demographic. You know, 47% of our children are racial and ethnic minorities, those less than 5 years of age. They know, we know, that racial and ethnic minorities and other vulnerable populations are at risk for receiving lesser quality health care, decreased access to health care, and having diminished health care outcomes. The Affordable Care Act that the president has signed into law really speaks to the role of health equity. It talks about making certain that patients get the right care, the quality care, with the best possible outcomes, regardless of how you think about race, ethnicity, gender, or class. If you think about in the state of Michigan, where, you know, the diabetes rate for African American, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans is greater than 10%. Greater than 10% for each one of those populations. In some populations, it's 16%. We also know, I talked to you about the children who are less than 5 years of age. They tend to suffer disproportionately from diseases like obesity, which is also associated with diabetes and decreased health outcomes. So we were thinking about this in a really thoughtful manner. You know, how can we do better? Michigan has a history of leadership and taking on big, messy problems and leading. And so that's what we intend to do here today.
And that's – so you are the leader of this. And so what do you see as your mission? How what does it look like to fix these inequities?
So our mission is to make certain – we start with really the patient care experience first. So really being the provider of choice. And if we get the clinical care right, create an environment where we have access to health care, where we make sure we provide high quality health care to everybody, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, class, religion, that will improve outcomes. So that's the clinical care mission. The other part of the mission is really thinking about the educational mission. How do we train doctors, nurses, in order to improve the quality of care? And then we start thinking about the research. How do we develop the research, the science? Where there is no science, we're going to create it. That if there are interventions that are needed in order to enhance the quality of care, enhance access, then that's what we're committed to doing.
So, and how will you do that? Let's talk about the care. People listening who perhaps are underinsured or uninsured and want to think that they'll get good care if they come to the hospital. How do you actually address that?
So if you look across the country, I think that there are several issues that will be facing healthcare in the next 10 to 20 years. One is, how do we make certain that we provide high-quality care, that it's safe? How do we address healthcare inequities? Every national agenda that focuses on health focuses on some of those issues. So Michigan is not alone mm-hmm. in the fact that, you know, we think that health care inequities are unacceptable. We're just going to do something about it. We're going to start by thinking about the data. How do we get the data? Can we sort of look inward and look at the quality of care that we provide? We're willing to do that. And if there are differences based upon race, if there are differences based upon gender, if there's differences based on your sexual orientation, then we're going to think about how we can intervene in order to close that particular gap.
So analyzing cases and
analyzing cases,
perhaps
analyzing
where things
data.
Weren't done as you want.
Exactly. We're going to talk to patients. So we're going to use basically big data, mm-hmm. and we're going to also use data that comes from our patients who tell us, you know, what they like and what they don't like. You may not realize, and this is a little bit of digression, but it's, you know, from 2003 to 2006, the cost of health care disparities was estimated to be $1.3 trillion. It is estimated that actually if we could eliminate those health care disparities, we could save almost $230 billion. So it's costing us. So when you think about health care in itself, we estimate that to be about $2 trillion. So we don't know the cost. I don't think any health system knows the cost of these health care inequities. We're going to work to try to find that out.
If you're just joining me, this is Stateside. I'm speaking today with Dr. Carmen Green. She's the newly appointed Associate Vice President for Health Equity and Inclusion at the University of Michigan Health System. Dr. Green, will there be or has there been sharing of data and initiatives with other health systems to kind of get this work that you're doing and get it spread out throughout the state?
So the American Hospital Association started talking about this. They've talked about diversity. They've talked about health equity issues. So it's on the radar screens. I would say that it's going to take a major health system to start addressing this issue, to bring sort of the convening type of role. I know that there are a number of institutions, a number of health care systems that are interested in this conversation. With that being said, we look forward to working with stakeholders. And so community engagement, how do we think about the community? Do we think about just the community of the people who provide the care? Or are we thinking about the community that who entrust their care to us? We need to be thinking about, and we will be thinking about, how can we reach out to some of the other major health systems so that we can have some comparative type of data. So we're excited about the opportunities. We're excited about talking about what we can bring to the table, what they can bring to the table. So this work is so important. And I say this work is so important in the fact that people have unfortunately died before their time. Mm. Okay. Or they're suffering disproportionately, that we know at the University of Michigan we cannot do this alone. So we will look to partner with anybody who's like-minded and wants to get to the bottom of this. I know that you have probably been touched by somebody who suffered disproportionately, who died before their time. I know the pain of that personally. And most people at other health systems know this as well. We're willing to work together.
I have to ask you, Dr. Green, the title of Associate Vice President for Health Equity and Inclusion is a very grand-sounding title, but I sense in you almost an evangelical fervor about this. What drives you personally to care so much about this issue of health equity?
Well, I'm just a worker bee, mm-hmm. first of all. And I've been a doctor for almost 20 years. And so I've been, you know, the proud recipient of really good care, and I've also seen people not receive good care. I started working in migrant clinics when I was in medical school, and I know the nobility of poverty by working. I learned more from the people who are working in the fields than I was supposed to learn just by being there to take their blood pressure mm-hmm. and their pulse. So I've been very privileged to work with lots of different people. But I also have been a daughter and a granddaughter. And I also know that we can do better. And so I don't think that we go out necessarily to give suboptimal care. But I know that we can provide better care, not just the University of Michigan. I'm talking about across the country. And that's the reason why I'm so passionate about this work.
And lead the way.
I'm hopeful.
Dr. Green, thank you for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you much.
Dr. Carmen Green, the Associate Vice President for Health Equity and Inclusion at the University of Michigan Health System.